"Just can't believe that remark," the politician went on for the minicam. We can all remember when people ran for re-election to Congress, and one of the things they told us was, "Vote for me because for every dollar that taxes take from this district, $1.20 comes back." Do you remember those claims? The president asked. What they didn't say was, well, it was actually a lot of things. Number one, whoever said that you depend on the government for money? We don't vote for Santa Claus, do we? It's the other way around. The government can't exist unless you give it money. Number two, are they telling you, vote for me 'cause I really stick it to those rotten people in North Dakota? Aren't they Americans, too? Number three, the real reason this happens is that the government deficit means every district gets more in federal payments than it lost in federal taxes. Excuse me, I mean direct federal taxes, the ones you can see. So they were bragging to you that they were spending more money than they had. If your next-door neighbor told you he was kiting checks drafted on your personal bank, you think maybe you might call the police about it? We all know that the government does take more than it gives back. They've just learned to hide it. The federal budget deficit means that every time you borrow money, it costs more than it should. Why? Because the government borrows so much money that it drives up interest rates. And so, ladies and gentlemen, every house payment, every car payment, every credit card bill is also a tax. And maybe they give you a tax break on interest payments. Isn't that nice? POTUS asked. Your government gives you a tax break on money you ought not to have to pay in the first place, and then it tells you that you get back more than you pay out. Ryan paused. Does anybody out there really believe that? Does anybody really believe it when people say that the United States can't afford not to spend more money than it has? Are these the words of Adam Smith or Lucy Ricardo? I have a degree in economics, and I Love Lucy wasn't on the course. Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a politician, and I am not here to speak on behalf of any of your local candidates for the vacant seats in the People's House. I am here to ask you to think. You, too, have a duty. The government belongs to you. You don't belong to it. When you go out to vote tomorrow, please take the time to think about what the candidates say and what they stand for. Ask yourself, does this make sense? And then make the best choice you can. And if you don't like any of them, go to the polls anyway. Go into the voting booth, and then go home without giving your vote to anyone, but at least show up. You owe that to your country. The heating and air conditioning van pulled up the driveway, and a pair of men got out and walked up to the porch. One of them knocked. Yes? The lady of the house asked in puzzlement. FBI, Mrs. Smitten. He showed his credentials. Could we come in, please? Why? The 62-year-old widow asked. We'd like you to help us with something, if you might. It had taken longer than expected. The guns used in the sandbox case had been traced to a manufacturer, from the manufacturer to a wholesaler, from the wholesaler to a dealer, and from the dealer to a name, and from a name to an address. With the address, the Bureau and Secret Service had gone to a United States District Court judge for a search and seizure warrant. Please come in. Thank you. Mrs. Smitten, do you know the gentleman who lives next door?
Mr. Azir, you mean?
That's right.
Not very well. Sometimes I wave.
Do you know if he's home now?
His car's not there, she replied after looking.
The agents already knew that. He owned a blue Oldsmobile wagon with Maryland tags. Every cop in 200 miles was looking for it. Do you know when the last time was you saw him?
Friday, I guess. There were some other cars there and a truck.
Okay. The agent reached in his coveralls pocket and pulled out a radio. Move in, move in. Bird is probably, say again probably, out of the coop. Before the widow's astonished eyes,
A helicopter appeared directly over the house 300 yards away. Zip lines dropped from both sides, and armed agents slid down them. At the same time, 4 vehicles converged from both directions on the country road, all of them driving off the road, onto the wide lawn straight toward the dwelling. Ordinarily, things would have gone slower, with some period of discreet surveillance, but the word was out on this one. Front and back doors were kicked in, and 30 seconds later, a siren went off. Mr. Azir, it seemed, had a burglar alarm. Then the radio crackled. "Clear. Building is clear. This is Betts. Search complete. Building is clear. Bring in the lab troops." With that, 2 vans appeared. These proceeded up the driveway, and one of the first things the passengers did was to take samples of the gravel there, plus grass, to match with scrapings from the rented cars left at Giant Steps. "Mrs. Smitten, could we sit down, please? There are a couple questions we'd like to ask you about Mr. Azir." "So?" Mary asked, arriving in the FBI command center. "No joy," the agent at the console said. "Damn." It wasn't said with passion. He'd never really expected it. But he expected some important information anyway. The lab had collected all manner of physical evidence. Gravel samples could match the driveway. Grass and dirt found on the inside of fenders and bumpers could link the vehicles to the Azir house. Carpet fibers, maroon wool, on the shoes of the dead terrorists could put them inside the house. Even now, a team of 10 agents was beginning the process of discovering exactly who Mordecai Azir was. Smart money was that he was about as Jewish as Adolf Eichmann. Nobody was covering that wager. "Commander Center, this is Betts." Billy Betts was assistant special agent in charge of the Baltimore Field Division, and a former HRT shooter, hence his dramatic descent from the helicopter, leading his men and a woman. "Billy, this is Dan Murray. What do you have?"
"Would you believe it? A half-empty crate of 7.62 ball ammo, and the lot numbers match, Director. Living room has a dark red wool rug. This is our place. Some clothes missing from the master bedroom closet. I'd say nobody's been here for a couple of days. Location is secure. No booby traps. The lab troops are starting their routine."
And all 80 minutes from the time the Baltimore SAC had walked into the Garments Federal Courthouse. Not fast enough, but fast. The forensics experts were a mix of Bureau, Service, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, a troubled agency whose technical staff was nonetheless excellent. They'd all be shaking the house for hours. Everyone wore gloves. Every surface would be dusted for fingerprints to match with those of the dead terrorists.
"Some weeks ago, you saw me take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's the second time I did that. The first time was as a brand new Marine second lieutenant, when I graduated from Boston College. Right after that, I read the Constitution, to make sure I knew what it was that I was supposed to be defending. Ladies and gentlemen, we often hear politicians saying how they want government to empower you so that you can do things. That's not the way it is," Ryan told them forcefully. "Thomas Jefferson wrote that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. That's you. The Constitution is something you should all read. The Constitution of the United States was not written to tell you what to do. The Constitution establishes the relationship among the 3 branches of government. It tells the government what it may do, and it also tells the government what it may not do. The government may not restrict your speech. The government may not tell you how to pray. The government may not do a lot of things. Government is a lot better at taking things away than it is at giving. But most of all, the government does not empower you. You empower the government. Ours is a government of the people. You are not people who belong to the government. Tomorrow you will not be electing masters. You will be choosing employees, servants of your will, guardians of your rights.
We do not tell you what to do. You tell us what to do. It is not my job to take your money and give it back. It is my job to take what money I must have to protect and serve you, and to do that job as efficiently as possible. Government service may be an important duty and a great responsibility, but it is not supposed to be a blessing for those who serve. It is your government servants who are supposed to sacrifice for you, not you who sacrifice for them. Last Friday, three good men and two good women lost their lives in the service of our country. They were there to protect my daughter, Katie. But there were other children there too. And in protecting one child, you protect all children. People like that do not ask for much more than your respect. They deserve that. They deserve it because they do things that we cannot easily do for ourselves. That's why we hire them. They sign on because they know that service is important, because they care about us, because they are us. You and I know that not all government employees are like that. That's not their fault. That's your fault. If you do not demand the best, you will not get the best. If you do not give the right measure of power to the right kind of people, then the wrong people will take more power than they need, and they will use it the way they want, not the way you want. Ladies and gentlemen, that's why your duty tomorrow to elect the right people to serve you is so important. Many of you operate your own businesses, and you hire people to work for you. Most of you own your own homes, and sometimes you hire plumbers, electricians, carpenters to do work for you. You try to hire the right people for the work because you pay for that work, and you want it done right. When your child is sick, you try to pick the best physician, and you pay attention to what that doctor does and how well he or she does it. Why? Because there is nothing more important to you than the life of your child. America is also your child. America is a country forever young. America needs the right people to look after her. It is your job to pick the right people, regardless of party or race or gender, or anything other than talent and integrity. I can't and I won't tell you which candidate merits your vote. God gave you a free will. The Constitution is there to protect your right to exercise that will. If you fail to exercise your will intelligently, then you have betrayed yourselves. And neither I nor anyone else can fix that for you. Thank you for coming to see me on my first visit to Colorado Springs. Tomorrow is your day. Please use it to hire the right people. In a series of speeches clearly designed to reach conservative voters, President Ryan is stumping the country on the eve of the House elections. But even as federal officials investigate the vicious terrorist attack on his own daughter, the president flatly rejected the idea of improved gun control laws. We have this report from NBC correspondent Hank Roberts, traveling with the presidential party today. Tom Donner continued looking into the camera until the red light went off. "I thought he said some pretty good things today," Plummer observed while the tape ran. "Invoking I Love Lucy must have come from Callie Weston on a serious PMS day," Donner observed, flipping through his copy. "Funny, she used to do great speeches for Bob Fowler." "Did you read the speech?" "John, come on, we don't have to read what he says. We know what he's going to say." 10 seconds, the director called over their earpieces. "Nice copy for later, by the way, John." The face broke into the smile at 3. A huge federal task force is now investigating Friday's attack on the president's daughter. We have this report from Karen Stabler in Washington. "I thought you'd like it, Tom," Plummer replied, when the light went dark again. So much the better, he thought. His conscience was clear now. The VC-25 lifted off on time and headed north to avoid some adverse weather over northern New Mexico. Arnie Van Dam was topside in the communications area. There were enough important-looking boxes to run half the world here, or so it seemed,
and hidden in the skin of the aircraft was a satellite dish whose expensive aiming system could track almost anything. At the chief of staff's direction, it was now getting the NBC feed off a Hughes bird.
We have this closing comment from special correspondent John Plummer.
Donner turned graciously.
John?
Thank you, Tom.
The profession of journalism is one I entered many years ago because I was inspired in my youth. I remember my crystal radio set. Those of you old enough might recall how you had to ground them to a pipe, he explained with a smile. I remember listening to Ed Murrow in London during the Blitz, to Eric Severide from the jungles of Burma, to all the founding fathers, giants, really, of our profession. I grew up with pictures in my mind painted by the words of men whom all America could trust to tell the truth to the best of their ability. I decided that finding the truth and communicating it to people was as noble a calling as any to which a man or woman could aspire. We're not always perfect in this profession. No one is, Plummer went on. To his right, Donner was looking at the teleprompter in puzzlement. This wasn't what was rolling in front of the camera lens, and he realized that, though Plummer had printed pages in front of him, he was giving a memorized speech. Imagine that. Just like the old days, apparently. I would like to say that I am proud to be in this profession. And I was, once. I was on the microphone when Neil Armstrong stepped down on the moon. And on sadder occasions, like the funeral of Jack Kennedy. But to be a professional does not mean merely being there. It means that you have to profess something, to believe in something, to stand for something. Some weeks ago, we interviewed President Ryan twice in one day. The first interview in the morning was taped, and the second one was done live. The questions were a little different. There's a reason for that. Between the first interview and the second, we were called over to see someone. I will not say who that was right now. I will later. That person gave us information. It was sensitive information aimed at hurting the president, and it looked like a good story at the time. It wasn't, but we didn't know that then. At the time, it seemed as though we had asked the wrong questions. We wanted to ask better ones. And so we lied. We lied to the president's chief of staff, Arnold Van Damme. We told him that the tape had been damaged somehow. In doing that, we also lied to the president. But worst of all, we lied to you. I have the tapes in my possession. They are not damaged in any way. No law was broken. The First Amendment allows us to do almost anything we want, and that's all right. Because you people out there are the final judge of what we do and who we are. But one thing we may not do is to break faith with you. I have no brief for President Ryan. Speaking personally, I disagree with him on many policy issues. If he should run for re-election, I will probably vote for someone else. But I was part of that lie, and I cannot live with it. Whatever his faults, John Patrick Ryan is an honorable man, and I am not supposed to allow my personal animus for or against anyone or anything to affect my work. In this case, I did. I was wrong. I owe an apology to the president, and I owe an apology to you. This might well be the end of my career as a broadcast journalist. If so, I want to leave it as I entered it. Telling the truth as best I can. Good night, from NBC News. Plummer took a very deep breath as he stared at the camera.
What the hell was that all about?
Plummer stood before he answered.
If you have to ask that question, Tom.
The phone on his desk rang. Actually, it had a blinking light. Plummer decided not to answer it, and instead walked to his dressing room. Tom Donner would have to figure it out all by himself.
2,000 miles away, over Rocky Mountain National Park, Arnold Van Damme stopped the machine, ejected the tape, and carried it down the circular stairs to the president's compartment in the nose. He saw Ryan going over his next and final speech of the day. "Jack, I think you will want to see this," the chief of staff told him with a broad grin. There has to be a first one of everything. This time it happened in Chicago. She'd seen her physician on Saturday afternoon and been told the same as everyone else. Flu, aspirin, liquids, bed rest. But looking in the mirror, she saw some discoloration on her fair skin. And that frightened her even more than the other symptoms she'd had to that point. She called her doctor, but she got only an answering machine. And those blotches could not wait. And so she got in her car and drove to the University of Chicago Medical Center, one of America's finest. She waited in the emergency room for about 40 minutes, and when her name was called, she stood and walked toward the desk. But she didn't make it, instead falling to the tile floor in sight of the administrative people. That caused some instant reactions, and a minute later, two orderlies had her on a gurney and were wheeling her back to the treatment area, her paperwork carried behind by one of the admissions people. The first physician to see her was a young resident most of the way through his first year of postgraduate study in internal medicine, doing his ER rotation and liking it. "What's the problem?" he asked, as the nursing staff went to work, checking pulse, blood pressure, and respiration. "Here," the woman from admission said, handing over the paper forms. The physician scanned them. "Flu symptoms, looks like, but what's this?" "Heart rate is 120. BP is..." "Wait a minute." The nurse ran it again. "Blood pressure is 90 over 50? She looked much too normal for that. The doctor was unbuttoning the woman's blouse, and there it was. The clarity of the moment made passages from his textbooks leap into his mind. The young resident held up his hands. "Everybody stop what you're doing. We may have a major problem here. I want everybody re-gloved, everybody masked, right now." "Temp is 104.4, another nurse said, stepping back from the patient. "This isn't flu. We have a major internal bleed, and those are petechiae." The resident got a mask and changed gloves as he spoke. "Get Dr. Quinn over here." A nurse trotted out while the resident looked again at the admission papers. "Might be vomiting blood, darkened stool. Depressed blood pressure, high fever, and subcutaneous bleeding." But this was Chicago, his mind protested. He got a needle. "Everybody stay clear, okay? Nobody get close to my hands and arms," he said, slipping the needle into the vein, then drawing 4 5-cc tubes. "What gives?" Dr. Joe Quinn asked. The resident recited the symptoms and posed his own question as he moved the blood tubes onto a table. "What do you think, Joe?" "If we were somewhere else." "Yeah, hemorrhagic fever, if that's possible." "Anybody ask her where she's been?" Quinn asked. "No, doctor," the admissions clerk replied. "Cold packs," the head nurse said, handing over an armload of them. These went under the armpits, under the neck, and elsewhere to bleed off the body's potentially lethal heat. "Dilantin?" Quinn wondered. "She's not convulsing yet." "Hell." The chief resident took out his surgical scissors and cut off the patient's bra. There were more petechiae forming on her torso. "We have a very sick lady here. Nurse, call Dr. Klein in infectious disease. He'll be at home now. Tell him we need him here at once. We have to get her temp down, wake her up, and find out where the hell she's been."
Chapter 47. Index Case.
Mark Klein was a full professor at the medical school, and therefore a man accustomed to regular working hours. Getting called in at almost 9 in the evening wasn't the usual thing for him, but he was a physician, and when called, he went. It was a 20-minute drive on this Monday night to his reserved parking space. He walked through the security staff with a nod, changed into scrubs, came into the emergency room from the back, and asked the charge nurse where Quinn was. "Isolation 2, doctor." He was there in 20 seconds,
and stopped cold when he saw the warning signs posted on the door.
Okay, he thought, donning a mask and gloves, then walking in.
Hi, Joe.
I don't want to make this call without you, Professor, Quinn said quietly, handing the chart over.
Klein scanned it, then his brain stopped cold, and he started from the beginning, looking up to compare the patient with the data. Female Caucasian, yes, age 41, about right, divorced, that was her business, apartment about 2 miles away, fine. Temperature on admission 104.4, pretty damn high. BP, that was awfully low.
Petechiae?
Let me take a look here, Klein said. The patient was coming around. The head was moving a little, and she was making some noise.
What's her temp now?
102.2, coming down nicely, the admitting resident replied, as Klein pulled the green sheet back. The patient was nude now, and the marks could hardly have been more plain on her otherwise very fair skin. Klein looked at the other doctors.
"Where's she been?"
"We don't know," Quinn admitted. "We looked through her purse. It seems she's an executive with Sears, office over in the tower."
"Have you examined her?"
"Yes, doctor," Quinn and the younger resident said together.
"Animal bites?" Klein asked.
"None. No evidence of needles, nothing unusual at all. She's clean."
"I'm calling it possible hemorrhagic fever. Method of transmission unknown for now. I want her upstairs, total isolation, full precautions. I want this room scrubbed, everything she touched."
"I thought these viruses only passed—"
"Nobody knows, doctor. And things I can't explain scare me. I've been to Africa. I've seen Lassa and Q fever. Haven't seen Ebola. But what she has looks a hell of a lot like one of those," Klein said, speaking those awful names for the first time.
"But how?"
"When you don't know, it means you don't know," Professor Klein said to the resident. "For infectious diseases, if you do not know the means of transmission, you assume the worst. The worst case is aerosol, and that's how this patient will be handled. Let's get her moved up to my unit. Everybody who's been in contact with her, I want you to scrub down. Like AIDS or hepatitis. Full precautions," he emphasized again.
"Where's the blood you drew?"
"Right there." The admitting physician pointed to a red plastic container.
"What's next?" Quinn asked.
"We get a sample off to Atlanta, but I think I'm going to take a look myself." Klein had a superb laboratory in which he worked every day, mainly on AIDS, which was his passion.
"Can I come with?" Quinn asked.
"I go off duty in a few minutes anyway." Monday was usually a quiet day for emergency rooms. Their hectic time was generally weekends.
"Sure."
"I knew Holtzman would come through for me," Arnie said. He was having a drink to celebrate, as the 747 began its descent into Sacramento.
"What?" the president asked.
"Bob's a tough son of a bitch, but he's an honest son of a bitch. That also means that he will honestly burn you at the stake if he thinks you have it coming. Always remember that," the chief of staff advised.
"Donner and Plummer lied," Jack said aloud. "Damn!"
"Everybody lies, Jack. Even you. It's a question of context. Some lies are designed to protect the truth. Some lies are designed to conceal it. Some are designed to deny it. And some lies happen because nobody gives a damn."
"And what happened here?"
"A combination, Mr. President. Ed Keelty wanted them to ambush you for him. And he suckered them. But I got that treacherous bastard for you. I'll bet that tomorrow there will be a front-page article in the Post exposing Keelty as the guy who suborned 2 very senior reporters, and the press will turn on him like a pack of wolves." The reporters riding in the back of the plane were already buzzing about it. Arnie had seen to it that the NBC news tape had run on the cabin video system.
"Because he's the one who made them look bad."
"You got it, boss," Van Damme confirmed, tossing off the remainder of his drink. He couldn't add that it might not have happened without the attack on Katie Ryan. Even reporters felt sympathy on occasion, which might have been decisive in Plummer's change of heart on the matter. But he was the one who'd made the carefully measured leaks to Bob Holtzman. He decided that he'd have a Secret Service agent find him a good cigar once they got on the ground. He felt like having one right now.
Adler's body clock was totally confused now. He found that catching catnaps helped, and it also helped that the message he was delivering was a simple and favorable one. The car stopped. A minor official opened the door for him and bowed curtly. Adler stifled a yawn as he walked into the ministry building.
"So good to see you again," the PRC foreign minister said, through his interpreter.
Zhang Hansan was there again, too, and made his own greeting.
"Your gracious agreement to allow direct flights certainly makes the process easier for me.
Thank you for that," Sextate replied, taking his seat.
"Just so you understand that these are exceptional circumstances," the foreign minister observed.
"Of course."
"What news do you bring us from our wayward cousins?"
"They are entirely willing to match your reductions in activity, with an eye toward reducing tension."
"And their insulting accusations?"
"Minister, that issue never arose. I believe that they are as interested as you in returning to peaceful circumstances."
"How good of them," Zhang commented. "They initiate hostilities, shoot down two of our aircraft, damage one of their own airliners, kill over 100 people, whether by deliberate act or by incompetence, and then they say that they will match us in reducing provocative acts. I hope your government appreciates the forbearance we are showing here."
"Mr. Minister, peace serves everyone's best interests, does it not? America appreciates the actions of both parties in these informal proceedings. The People's Republic has indeed been gracious in more than one way, and the government in Taiwan is willing to match your actions. What more is required than that?"
"Very little," the foreign minister replied. "Merely compensation for the deaths of our four aviators. Each of them left a family behind."
"Their fighters did shoot first," Zhang pointed out.
"That may be true, but the question of the airliner is still undetermined."
"Certainly we had nothing to do with that."
This came from the foreign minister.
There were few things more boring than negotiations between countries, but there was actually a reason for that. Sudden or surprise moves could force a country into making impromptu decisions. Unexpected pressure caused anger, and anger had no place in high-level discussions and decisions. Therefore, important talks were almost never decisive, but were rather evolutionary in nature, which gave each side time to think through its position, and that of the other side, carefully, so to arrive at a final communique with which both sides could be relatively content. Thus the demand for compensation was a violation of the rules. More properly done, this would have been said at the first session, and Adler would have taken it to Taipei and probably presented it as his own suggestion after the Republic of China government had agreed to cooperate in the reduction of tension. But they had already done that, and now the PRC wanted him to take back the request for compensation instead of a formula for local détente. That was an insult to the Taiwanese government, and also a measured insult to the American government for having been used as a stalking horse for another country. This was all the more true since Adler and the ROC knew who'd killed the airliner, and who had therefore shown contempt for human life, for which the PRC now demanded compensation. And now Adler wondered again how much of what he knew of the incident was known to the PRC. If they knew a lot, then this was definitely a game whose rules had yet to be decoded.
"I think it would be more useful if both sides were to cover their individual losses and needs," Secretary Adler suggested.
"I regret that we cannot accept that. It is a matter of principle, you see. He who commits the improper act must make amends."
"But what if—"
"I do not have any evidence to suggest this, but what if it is determined that the PRC inadvertently damaged the airliner? In such a case, your request for compensation might appear unjust."
"That is not possible. We have interviewed our surviving pilots, and their reports are unequivocal."
Again, it was Zhang.
"What precisely do you request?" Adler asked.
$200,000 for each of the four aviators lost. The money will go to their families, of course, Zhang promised.
I can present this request to...
Excuse me. It is not a request. It is a requirement, the foreign minister told Adler.
I see. I can present your position to them, but I must urge you not to make this a condition of your promise to reduce tension.
That is our position. The foreign minister's eyes were quite serene.
And God bless America, Ryan concluded.
The crowd stood and cheered. The band struck up. There had to be a band everywhere he went, Jack supposed. And he made his way off the dais behind a wall of nervous Secret Service agents. Well, the president thought, no gunfire out of the blinding lights this time either. He stifled another yawn. He'd been on the move for over 12 hours. Four speeches didn't seem to be all that much physical work, but Ryan was learning just how exhausting public speaking could be. You had the shakes every time before getting up there, and though you got over it in a few minutes, the accumulated stress did take its toll. The dinner hadn't helped much. The food had been bland, so carefully chosen to offend no one that it wasn't worth anyone's attention. But it had given him heartburn anyway.
Okay, Arnie told him, as the presidential party assembled to head out the back door. For a guy who was ready to chuck it yesterday, you did awfully well.
Mr. President, a reporter called.
Talk to him, Arnie whispered.
Yes, Jack said, walking over, to the displeasure of his security force.
Do you know about what John Plummer said this evening on NBC?
The reporter was ABC and unlikely to pass on the chance to slam a competing network.
Yes, I've heard about it, the president replied soberly.
Do you have any comment?
Obviously, I do not like learning about all this. But as far as Mr. Plummer is concerned, that's as gracious an act of moral courage as I've seen in quite a while. He's okay in my book.
Do you know who it was who... Please, let Mr. Plummer handle that. It's his story, and he knows how to tell it. Now, if you will excuse me, I have a plane to catch.
Thank you, Mr. President, the ABC reporter said to Ryan's back.
Just right, Arnie said with a smile. We've had a long day, but it's been a good day.
Ryan let out a long breath.
You say so.
Oh, my God, Professor Klein whispered.
There it was on the display monitor. The shepherd's crook right out of a medical text. How the hell had it come to Chicago?
That's Ebola, Dr. Quinn said, adding, that's not possible.
How thorough was your physical examination? The senior man asked again.
Could have been better, but no bite marks, no needle marks. Mark, it's Chicago. I had frost on my windshield the other day.
Professor Klein pressed his hands together and pushed his gloved fingers up against his nose. Then he stopped the gesture when he realized that he was still wearing a surgical mask.
Keys in her purse?
Yes, sir.
First, we have cops around the ER. Get one. Tell him we need a police escort to go to her apartment and allow us to look around. Tell him this woman's life is in danger. Maybe she's got a pet, a tropical plant, something.
We have the name of her physician. Get him up. Get him in here. We need to find out what he knows about her.
Treatment?
We cool her down, we keep her hydrated, we medicate for pain, but there isn't anything that really works on this. Rousseau in Paris has tried interferon and a few other things, but no luck so far.
He frowned at the display again.
How'd she get it? How the hell did she contract this little bastard?
CDC?
You get the cop up here. I'll get a fax off to Gus Lorenz. Klein checked his watch.
Damn.
The Predator drones were back in Saudi, having never been discovered. It was felt that having them circle over a stationary position, like a divisional encampment, was a little too dangerous, however. And now the overhead work was being done by satellites, whose photos downloaded to the National Reconnaissance Office.
Check this out, one of the night crew said to the guy at the next workstation. What are these?
The tanks of the UIR Immortals Division were grouped in what was essentially a large parking lot, all evenly spaced in long, regular lines so that they could be counted. A stolen tank with a full basic load of shells was a dangerous thing to have on the loose, and all armies took security of the tank loggers seriously. It also made things more convenient for the maintenance personnel to have them all together. Now they were all back, and men were swarming over the tanks and other fighting vehicles, doing the normal maintenance that followed a major exercise. In front of every tank in the first row were two dark lines, each about a meter across and 10 meters long. The man on the screen was ex-Air Force, and more expert on airplanes than land combat vehicles. His neighbor only needed one look. Trax.
What?
They're rotating the tires, like. Trax wear out, and you put new ones on. The old ones go into the shop to be worked on, replacing pads and stuff, the former soldier explained. It's no big deal. Closer examination showed how it was done. The new tracks were laid in front of the old ones. The old ones were then disconnected and attached to the new, and the tank, its motor running, simply drove forward, the sprocket wheel pulling the new track in place over the road wheels. It required several men and was hot, heavy work, but it could be done by a well-trained tank crew in about an hour under ideal conditions, which, the ex-soldier explained, these were. Essentially, the tank drove onto the new tracks.
I never knew how they did that.
Beats having to jack the sumbitch off the ground.
What's a track good for?
On one of these, cross-country in a desert?
Oh, call it 1,000 miles. Maybe a little less.
Sure enough, the two couches in Air Force One's forward cabin folded out to make beds. After dismissing his staff, Ryan hung up his clothes and lay down. Clean sheets and everything, and he was weary enough that he didn't mind being on an airplane. Flight time to Washington was 4.5 hours, and then he'd be able to sleep some more in his own bed. Unlike normal red-eye travelers, he might even be able to do some useful work the next day. In the big cabin, aft, the reporters were doing the same, having decided to leave the issue of Plummer's astounding revelation to the next day. They had no choice in the matter. A story of this magnitude was handled at least at the assistant managing editor level. Many of the print journalists were dreaming about the editorials that would appear in the papers. The TV reporters were trying not to cringe at what this would mean to their credibility. In between were the president's staff members. They were all smiles, or nearly so.
"Well, I finally saw his temper," Arnie told Callie Weston.
"Big time."
"And I bet he saw yours, too."
"And mine won." Arnie sipped at his drink.
"You know the way things are going, I think we have a pretty good president here."
"He hates it." Weston had one of her own. Arnie Van Damme didn't care.
"Fabulous speeches, Callie."
"There's such an engaging way about how he delivers them," she thought. "Every time, he starts off tight, embarrassed, and then the teacher in him takes over, and he really gets into it. He doesn't even know it, either."
"Honesty. It really does come out, doesn't it?" Arnie paused.
"There's going to be a memorial service for the dead agents."
"I'm already thinking about it," Weston assured him. "What are you going to do about Keelty?"
"I'm thinking about that. We're going to sink that bastard once and for all."
Badrine was back on his computer, checking the proper internet sites. Still nothing. In another day, he might start worrying. Though it wasn't really his problem if nothing happened, was it? Everything he'd done had gone perfectly.
Patient Zero opened her eyes, which got everyone's attention. Her temperature was down to 101.6, entirely due to the cold packs that now surrounded her body like a fish in the market. The combination of pain and exhaustion was plain on her face. In that way, she looked like a patient with advanced AIDS, a disease with which the physician was all too familiar.
"Hello, I'm Dr. Klein," the professor told her from behind his mask. "You had us a little worried there for a minute, but things are under control now."
"Hurts," she said.
I know, and we are going to help you with that, but I need to ask you a few questions. Can you help me with a few things? Klein asked.
Okay.
Have you been doing any traveling lately?
What do you mean?
Every word she spoke drew down on her energy resources. Have you been out of the country?
No. Flew to Kansas City. 10 days ago, that's all. Day trip, she added.
Okay. It wasn't. Have you had any contact with someone who's been out of the country?
No.
She tried to shake her head. It moved maybe a quarter inch. Forgive me, but I have to ask this. Do you have any ongoing sexual relationships at the moment?
That question shook her.
AIDS? She gasped, thinking that was the worst thing she might have. Klein shook his head emphatically. No, definitely not. Please don't worry about that.
Divorced, the patient said. Just a few months. No new men in my life yet.
Well, as pretty as you are, that'll have to change soon, Klein observed, trying to get a smile out of her. What do you do at Sears?
Housewares. Buyer. Just had big show. McCormick Center. Lots of paperwork. Orders and things.
This was going nowhere. Klein tried a few more questions. They led nowhere. He turned and pointed to the nurse. Okay, we're going to do something about the pain now, the professor told her. He stepped away so as not to crowd the nurse when she started the morphine on the IV tree. This will start working in a few seconds, okay? I'll be back soon. Quinn was waiting out in the hall with a uniformed police officer, a checkerboard band around his cap. Doc, what's the story? The cop asked. The patient has something very serious, possibly very contagious. I need to look over her apartment.
That's not really legal, you know. You're supposed to go to a judge and get...
Officer, there's no time for that. We have her keys. We could just break in, but I want you there so that you can say we didn't do anything wrong. And besides, if she had a burglar alarm, it wouldn't do for them to be arrested. There's no time to waste. This woman is very sick.
Okay, my car is outside.
The cop pointed and the doctors followed.
Get the facts off to Atlanta, Quinn asked.
Klein shook his head. Let's look at her place first. He decided not to wear a coat. It was cold outside, and the temperature would be very inhospitable to the virus in the unlikely event that it had somehow gotten on his scrubs. Reason told him that there was no real danger here. He'd never encountered Ebola clinically, but he knew as much about it as any man could. It was regrettably normal for people to show up with diseases whose presence they could not explain. Most of the time, careful investigation would reveal how it had been contracted, but not always. Even with AIDS, there was the handful of unexplained cases. But only a handful, and you didn't start with one of those as your index case. Professor Klein shivered when he got outside. The temperature was in the low 30s, with a north wind blowing down off Lake Michigan. But that wasn't the reason for his shaking. Price opened the door to the nose cabin. The lights were off, except for a few faint indirect ones. The president was lying on his back and snoring loudly enough to be heard over the whining drone of the engines. She had to resist the temptation to tiptoe in and cover him with a blanket. Instead, she smiled and closed the door.
"Maybe there is such a thing as justice, Jeff," she observed to Agent Raymond.
"The newsy thing, you mean?"
"Yeah."
"Don't bet on it," the other agent said. They looked around. Finally, everyone was asleep, even the chief of staff. Topside, the flight crew was doing their job, along with the other USAF personnel. And it really was like a red-eye flight back to the East Coast, as Air Force One passed over central Illinois. The two agents moved back to their seating area. Three members of the detail were playing cards quietly. Others were reading or dozing. An Air Force sergeant came down the circular steps holding a folder.
"Flash traffic for the boss," she announced.
Is it that important we get into Andrews in about 90 minutes?
I just take him off the fax machine, the sergeant pointed out.
Okay.
Price took the message and headed aft, to where Ben Goodley was. It was his job to be around to tell the president what he needed to know about the important happenings in the world, or in this case, to evaluate the importance of a message. Price shook the man's shoulder. The National Intelligence officer opened one eye.
Yeah?
Do we wake the boss for this?
The intelligence specialist scanned it and shook his head.
It can wait. Adler knows what he's doing, and there's a working group at state for this.
He turned back into his seat without another word.
Don't touch anything, Klein told the policeman. Best for you to stand right by the door, but if you want to follow us around, don't touch a thing. Wait.
The physician reached into the plastic trash bag he'd brought along and pulled out a surgical mask in a sterile container.
Put this on, okay?
Anything you say, Doc.
Klein handed over the house key. The police officer opened the door. It turned out that there was an alarm system. The control panel was just inside the door, but not turned on. The two physicians put on their own masks and donned latex gloves. First, they turned on all the lights.
What are we looking for? Quinn asked.
Klein was already looking. No cat or dog had come to note their arrival. He saw no bird cages. Part of him had hoped for a pet monkey, but somehow he knew that wasn't in the cards. Ebola didn't seem to like monkeys very much anyway. It killed them with all the alacrity it applied to human victims. Plants, then, he thought. Wouldn't it be odd if Ebola's host was something other than an animal? That would be a first of sorts. There were plants, but nothing exotic. They stood in the center of the living room, not touching anything with their gloved hands or even with their green-trousered legs, as they turned around slowly, looking.
I don't see anything, Quinn reported.
Neither do I. Kitchen.
There were some more plants there, two that looked like herbs in small pots. Klein didn't recognize their type and decided to lift them.
Wait. Here, Quinn said, opening a drawer and finding freezer bags.
The plants went into those bags, which the younger physician sealed carefully. Klein opened the refrigerator. Nothing unusual there. The same was true of the freezer. He'd thought it possible that some exotic food product, but no. Everything the patient ate was typically American. The bedroom was a bedroom and nothing more. No plants there, they saw.
Some article of clothing? Leather? Quinn asked.
Anthrax can. Ebola can't. It's too delicate. We know the organism we're dealing with. It can't survive in this environment. It just can't, the professor insisted.
They didn't know much about the little bastard, but one of the things they did at CDC was to establish the environmental parameters, how long the virus could survive in a whole series of conditions. Chicago at this time of year was as inhospitable to that sort of virus as a blast furnace. Orlando, someplace in the south maybe, but Chicago?
We got nothing, he concluded in frustration.
Maybe the plants?
You know how hard it is to get a plant through customs?
I've never tried.
I have. Tried to bring some wild orchids back from Venezuela once.
He looked around some more.
There's nothing here, Joe.
Is her prognosis as bad as...
Yeah.
A pair of gloved hands rubbed against the scrub pants. Inside the latex rubber, his hands were sweating now.
If we can't determine where it came from... If we can't explain it...
He looked at his younger, taller colleague.
I have to get back. I want to take another look at that structure.
Hello, Gus Lauren said.
He checked his clock.
What the hell?
Gus?
The voice asked.
Yes, who's this?
Mark Klein in Chicago.
Something wrong? Lauren asked groggily.
The reply opened his eyes all the way.
I think... No, Gus, I know I have an Ebola case up here.
How can you be sure?
I have the crook. I micrographed it myself.
It's the shepherd's crook, and no mistake, Gus.
I wish it were.
Where's he been?
It's a she, and she hasn't been anywhere special.
Klein summarized what he knew in less than a minute.
There is no immediately apparent explanation for this.
Lawrence could have objected that this was not possible, but the medical community is an intimate one at its higher levels. He knew Mark Klein was a full professor at one of the world's finest medical schools.
Just one case?
They all start with one, Gus, Klein reminded his friend. 1,000 miles away, Lauren swung his legs off the bed and onto the floor.
Okay, I need a specimen. I have a courier on the way to O'Hare now. He'll catch the first flight down. I can email you the micrographs right now.
Give me about 40 minutes to get in.
Gus?
Yes?
Is there anything on the treatment side that I don't know?
We have a very sick patient here, Klein said, hoping that for once maybe he wasn't fully up to speed on something in his field.
Afraid not, Mark. Nothing new that I know about.
Damn.
Okay, we'll do what we can here. Call me when you get there. I'm in my office.
Lawrence went into the bathroom and ran some water to splash in his face, proving to himself that this wasn't a dream.
No, he thought. Nightmare.
This presidential perk was one even the press respected. Ryan walked down the steps first, saluted the USAF sergeant at the bottom, and walked the 50 yards to the helicopter. Inside, he promptly buckled his belt and went back to sleep. 15 minutes later, he was roused from his seat again, walked down another set of stairs, saluted a Marine this time, and headed into the White House. 10 minutes after that, he was in a sleeping place that didn't move.
"Good trip?" Kathy asked, one eye partly open.
"Long one," her husband reported, falling back to sleep. The first flight from Chicago to Atlanta left the gate at 6:15 a.m. Central Time. Before then, Lawrence was in his office, on his computer terminal, dialed into the Internet and on the phone at the same time. "I'm downloading the image now." As the older man watched, the micrograph grew from top to bottom, one line at a time, faster than a fax would come out of a machine, and far more detailed.
"Tell me I'm wrong, Gus," Klein said, no hope in his voice at all.
"I think you know better, Mark." He paused as the image finished forming.
"That's our friend.
Where's he been lately?"
"Well, we had a couple of cases in Zaire, and 2 more reported in Sudan. That's it as far as I know.
Your patient, has she been—"
"No. There aren't any risk factors that I have been able to identify so far.
Given the incubation period, she must almost certainly have contracted it here in Chicago. And that's not possible, is it?"
"Sex?" Lawrence asked.
He could almost hear the shake of the head over the phone.
"I asked. She says she's not getting any of that.
Any reports anyplace else?"
"None. None anywhere."
"Mark, are you sure of what you've told me?"
As insulting as the question was, it had to be asked.
"I wish I weren't. The micrograph I sent is the 3rd one. I wanted good isolation for it. Her blood is full of it, Gus."
"Wait a minute."
He heard a muffled conversation.
"She just came around again. Says she had a tooth extracted a week or so ago. We have the name of her dentist. We'll run that one down. That's all we have here."
"All right. Let me get set up for your sample."
"It's only one case. Let's not get too excited."
Raymond got home shortly before dawn. It was just as well that the streets were almost entirely devoid of traffic at this time of day. He was in no condition for safe driving. Arriving home, he followed the usual routine. On his answering machine was another wrong number, the voice of Mr. Alahad. The pain was so severe that it woke him up from the sleep of exhaustion. Just walking the 20 feet from the bed and into the bathroom,
seemed like a marathon's effort, but he managed to stagger that far. The cramping was terrible, which amazed him, because he hadn't eaten all that much in the past couple of days, despite his wife's